Hello, and welcome to Science World. Leading space experts recently gathered at NASA's headquarters here in Washington, D.C. to discuss the search for life beyond Earth. We'll hear what the experts had to say about discovering possibly habitable worlds out in the cosmos. The week-long 20th International AIDS Conference came to a close on Friday. Participants from around the world gathered in Melbourne, Australia, to discuss and learn about the current state of AIDS research. And this past week, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced that this past June was the hottest June since record-keeping began in 1880. On today's one-on-one segment, we'll talk with the author of that report to learn more about the record-breaking temperatures and the conditions that control our climate. These stories and more are coming your way on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. A panel of space experts recently gathered at NASA headquarters here in Washington, D.C. to talk about the search for life beyond our own planet. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us about that meeting in this report by George Putich.
When NASA launched the Kepler Space Telescope in 2009, scientists learned something new and quite significant, says the director of the Space Telescope Science Institute, Matt Mountain.
Our galaxy has at least 100 billion planets in it. And we didn't know that 5 years ago.
Of course, Kepler and today's other powerful telescopes can't actually see those planets. They're too faint against the light of their stars. But scientists can measure the change of light when they pass in front of the star and analyze that light passing through their atmosphere to determine what's in it. NASA's astrophysicist and former astronaut John Grunsfeld explains.
Well, if we were looking at Earth, we would see signs of our sky, our blue sky. We would see signs of oxygen, of carbon dioxide, of sulfur dioxide from volcanoes, and we might even see signatures that there was plant life, and we see that by dissecting the light into its component colors.
Most of the planets discovered so far are unlike Earth. They are too big, too small, too close to their sun, or too far away to support life. But astrophysicist Sarah Seeger says small planets the size of Earth are extremely common.
We are looking for biological signatures, gases that are produced by life, gases that don't belong in the atmosphere.
In cooperation with the European Space Agency and scientists from other nations, NASA is building the next generation of space telescopes that may be able to find evidence of life. The James Webb Space Telescope, scheduled to be deployed in 2018, will have unprecedented sensitivity and resolution that will greatly improve the spectroscopic analysis of distant stars and planets. NASA's chief scientist Ellen Stofan says the agency also plans to look for life on Jupiter's moon Europa, which may have an ocean under its ice cover.
In our own solar system, we know where to go, we know what to measure, and we're in the process of doing just that. Looking out beyond our solar system, we're on the right track, we're making the right measurements, and we're just on the cusp of learning so much.
Scientists say there's a very high probability that they will find a planet very much like Earth. That could help answer the question, how hard is it for life to get a foothold in the universe? For George Putich, I'm Doug Bernard.
The week-long International AIDS Conference came to a close on Friday. Philip Alexio has more.
Delegates to the 20th International AIDS Conference assembled this past week in Melbourne, Australia, for speeches, seminars, and meetings to examine the current state of AIDS research. About 12,000 delegates, including scientists, activists, and people living with the disease, came together to discuss community responses to HIV and AIDS and ways to accelerate prevention and treatment. International AIDS Society President Francois Barry-Sanosi called for a moment of silence at the opening ceremony Sunday evening to pay tribute to six delegates who were on the Malaysia Airlines flight that was shot down over Ukraine last week, killing all 298 on board. For Science World, I'm Philip Alexio.
Seals are foraging for food at offshore wind farms and underwater pipes, according to a study that describes this new behavior. Roseanne Skirbel reports.
Offshore wind farms are harnessing more than wind, says study lead author Deborah Russell with the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. She's found the marine turbines are attracting seals. She and her colleagues monitored the location and behavior of 100 seals off the British and Dutch coastlines by tracking GPS tags glued to the animals' backs.
It's actually quite interesting. The tags transmit that data through the mobile phone system. So they kind of send text messages about where the seals are and where they've been, and information about their activity.
The aim was to better understand the interaction between seals and wind turbines and underwater pipes. The scientists charted grid patterns with the GPS data that show seals visited the structures, sometimes repeatedly. Russell says expected increase in the number of these structures is certain to have consequences.
The presence of an operational wind farm may make the area less attractive to mammals due to an increase in noise because of operating wind turbines. However, conversely, they may make the habitat more attractive by increasing prey availability, by decreasing fishing activity, or in this case, we think it's actually the anthropogenic structures can result in artificial reefs.
Russell says that artificial reef could set up a new dynamic in the food chain.
If the structures increase the overall abundance of prey in the environment, then they may provide a sustainable new foraging opportunities for these predators. And in this case, the structures should really be designed to maximize these ecological benefits. However, in contrast, if the prey, which were previously sparsely distributed, are simply concentrated at these structures, it makes them very vulnerable to be hoovered up by marine predators such as seals.
These are issues, Russell says, that must be examined in future studies to better inform decision makers and the public about the best development practices for the mammals and the ocean environment. The study appears in the latest issue of the journal Current Biology. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
In a few minutes, we'll learn why this past June was the hottest June since records were first kept in the late 1800s. So, since we'll be talking about record high temperatures, for this week's quick quiz, we want to know what location the World Meteorological Organization considers to be the hottest on Earth. Is it A, El Azizia, Libya, B, Doha, Qatar, or C, Death Valley, California? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Users of social media and email often represent themselves through photos or cartoon images. These two-dimensional images may soon be replaced by 3D avatars of the users. Elizabeth Lee tells us more from Los Angeles.
Imagine two-dimensional photos and avatars in social media being replaced by three-dimensional representations of the actual user. Research scientist Ari Shapiro says that technology is just around the corner.
For me, it's exciting to see that a lot of people have the capability to model themselves very, very quickly for almost no cost.
Shapiro demonstrated how the 3D avatar technology works at an open house at the Mixed Reality Lab, a part of the University of Southern California Institute for Creative Technologies. One of the attendees, Jason Suh, received a quick body scan and within minutes saw an avatar of himself moving around on a computer monitor.
It was insane. Within like a minute or so, they got a copy of me, a 3D model of me, had me like jumping and running. Since it's an avatar of yourself, you could probably use it on like Facebook or something and like personalize yourself and like have a 3D model of yourself on Facebook rather than just having like a profile picture.
Users will need the software, a computer, and a scanner such as the Microsoft Kinect to get a 360-degree body scan to create the avatar. Since the process takes only a few minutes, users can change the look of the avatar every day. The technology captures the person's clothes, hairstyle, and accessories, such as glasses or a purse. The computer software then uses a variety of stored animations to make the avatar come to life. Shapiro says 3D avatars can change the social media experience and make people feel more connected.
So if you can imagine having a Facebook page where you have not only you typing some information, but your virtual character speaks the information, or some sort of social application where you and your friends and your family are shown as these avatars. So we believe that there's a very interesting psychological effect that's going to happen when people start seeing themselves and families and friends inside these simulations. We think it'll be very powerful.
Three-dimensional avatars created for Hollywood movies can cost millions of dollars, but this type of avatar is much cheaper.
We expect it's going to be on the order of $10, $50, maybe $100 tops for a piece of software that can capture you and simulate you.
There is a trade-off for the low price tag. For the moment, these avatars are missing some fine details, such as dimples and the creasing of the eyes. But Shapiro says as sensor technology improves, so will the quality. He is also working on capturing movements and behaviors, such as how a person walks and interacts and socializes with others, to create 3D avatars with personality. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
A fossil found in Inner Mongolia may prove that birds did not evolve from dinosaurs, as many scientists have believed, but from a creature that existed long before. Faith Lapidus tells us more in this report from Amy Liu.
The Scansoriopteris, which means climbing wing, could change the theory that birds evolved from dinosaurs. When University of North Carolina biology professor Alan Fiducia examined the fossil, he found something more bird-like than dinosaur-like.
It's just not a dinosaur. In other words, there's not anything about this creature that allows classifying it as a dinosaur.
The study, published in the Journal of Ornithology, points out several bird-like features, like the foot.
And it has a perching foot in which the first toe is rotated to the rear. And this is, of course, a perching foot. So we know that it was a perching animal.
Even the hip joint, he says, does not appear to be built for walking like a dinosaur would. Fiducia says it adds to the evidence that birds did not evolve from ground-dwelling dinosaurs.
If you look at dinosaurs in general and go back to the early dinosaurs, they tend to have possibly the worst anatomical design for the evolution of flight.
For instance, short forelimbs like the T-Rex probably would not have evolved into longer structures like wings. However, he adds, it's quite possible to take to the air by gliding down from trees, like flying squirrels or gliding possums do. Even bats that actually fly do not routinely take off from the ground.
Every group of flying vertebrates, regardless of the order they come from, all evolve flight from the trees down. It's the simplest mechanism.
Alan Fiducia says that the Scansoriopteris defines a new class of creatures completely separate from the dinosaurs and adds to the growing knowledge of the earliest life on Earth. For writer Amy Liu, I'm Faith Lapidus.
A fly with a remarkable sense of hearing is the model for what may be a new generation of hypersensitive hearing aids and other sonic devices. Roseanne Skirbel buzzes back with this story.
Ormia ochraca is a parasite. As part of its life cycle, it deposits larvae on a cricket. The larvae burrow into the cricket and consume it from the inside out. The tiny yellow fly, native to Central America and the southern United States, finds its host by listening for its high-pitched chirp, which it can hear from as far away as the length of a football field, and pinpointing its location.
And that was baffling to the acoustics community because an insect that small should not be able to localize sound that good.
That's acoustic engineer Neil Hall. In the journal Applied Physics Letters, he and colleagues at the University of Texas report on a prototype of the fly's hearing structure they've built based on previous studies.
And they discovered that it was doing it through a very clever mechanism where instead of using two independent ears like a human would, the fly's ears are actually coupled.
The fly's ears are 2 millimeters apart, a separation so slight that sound reaches one ear just 4 millionths of a second before arriving at the other. That should make it impossible to identify where a sound is coming from, but inside this fly's ear is what looks like a tiny seesaw, 1.5 millimeters long. Pressure waves force a motion that increases the sound delay, allowing the fly to locate and zero in on its prey. Hall and his team copied the seesaw mechanism in silicon. They also use special electric materials that allow them to simultaneously measure its flexing and rotation.
What we were able to accomplish with this prototype is exactly what the fly itself does, which is to localize audible sound. After discerning the motion of the structure, we were able to compute the direction of the sound source.
Hall sees applications of the work moving in two directions. On the battlefront, where sensors would be critical to localize where shots are originating, and in healthcare, to supply hearing devices that could filter out distracting background sound.
One thing the fly teaches us how to do is to hear in a certain direction while rejecting sound coming from other directions. That is a feature that is incredibly useful for hearing aids, for example. Where right now, if you turn up the gain of a hearing aid or turn up the volume to hear someone across from you, it also amplifies everything else in the room.
Hall says the remaining challenge in bringing such products to market is to make them practical to handle. Because the device is so small, it's delicate, he says, a concern that the fly does not have to worry about. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
It's time to find out if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We wanted to know what location the World Meteorological Organization considers the hottest on Earth. Is it A, El Azizia, Libya, B, Doha, Qatar, or C, Death Valley, California? The answer is C, Death Valley, California. For years, the hottest temperature ever recorded was considered to be 58 degrees Celsius, set in 1922 in answer A, El Azizia, Libya. But in 2012, the World Meteorological Organization invalidated that record temperature and determined that 56.7 degrees Celsius was instead the highest temperature ever. That searing temperature was measured at Furnace Creek Ranch in Death Valley, California, right here in the United States, on July 10, 1913. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
This past week, scientists from the United States National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced that they found that the global average temperature for this past June was the highest for June since record-keeping began in 1880. Now, while the world in general was warmer than average in June, record temperatures were also measured from southeastern Greenland to parts of northern South America and portions of Central Africa to sections of southern and southeastern Asia. But then a few areas in North America, eastern Russia, and various parts of Europe were either cooler or much cooler than average. June 1976 was when the last below-average global temperature for June was measured. February 1984 marked the last time a below-average global temperature for any month was measured. Climate scientist Dr. Jessica Blunden works in the climate monitoring branch at NOAA's National Climatic Data Center. She authors the Global Climate Analysis Report issued by NOAA each month and is one of the editors for the recently released State of the Climate in 2013 that outlines climatic trends throughout the previous year. Dr. Blunden joins us today to talk about June's record temperatures and the various meteorological conditions that control our climate. What was the average global temperature, and how does this compare to the month of June in past years?
This year in June, the average temperature was about 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit or 0.72 degrees Celsius higher than a 20th century average. So this breaks the old record by about 0.05 degrees Fahrenheit, which may not sound like a lot, but in terms of temperature departures from average, it's quite high.
So how is this significant? You're saying it's quite high.
Usually when you break a temperature record, you may break it by 1/100th of a degree or 2/100ths of a degree, and this is higher than we typically see.
This particular finding is an average of all temperatures around the world, different parts of the world. Can you break this down for us as far as what areas had the highest gains in temperature and what areas had the least gains in temperature?
If you look at areas that were the warmest, there were some areas in Canada that actually had temperatures that were close to 5 degrees Celsius above average. Australia had a lot of warmth. New Zealand was record warm down there for the month of June. There were a few other areas that were record warm. We had in the higher latitudes, parts of Greenland saw record warmth. Across the equator, parts of Africa and northern South America also saw record warmth. And when we say global temperatures, we mean temperatures across land and ocean surfaces. So we're not just looking at land, but we're also looking at ocean temperatures. And we had record high ocean temperatures as well during June. In fact, the ocean temperatures with respect to a departure from average were the highest they've ever been for any month on record.
And what do you think some of the contributing factors to that would be? I know on a global basis, we would consider global warming, but are there any regional specific reasons why this would happen?
Right. So you're looking at two factors when you're looking at the warmth. One, you're looking at long-term temperature trends. So we are seeing general warming over time due to climate change, global warming. On top of that, you also have natural variations in climate patterns that can impact different parts of the world. And probably the biggest driver behind that is the El Niño Southern Oscillation. That's probably what most people are also familiar with. You have El Niño, which is the warm phase, and we measure that in the central and eastern equatorial Pacific Ocean. So when ocean temperatures are higher than half a degree Celsius in that region, then we know that we're moving into an El Niño phase. And we've been moving into that warm phase throughout the beginning of 2014. So we've been seeing increasing temperatures there. So that's driving a lot of the warmth. We've also been seeing much warmer than average, even record high temperatures in the northeastern Pacific Ocean and all across the Indian Ocean and the western Pacific Ocean. On the other side of the spectrum, we had record wet areas in the central United States. And so that was probably the wettest area of the world. So you do see different extremes. It's not the same, course, in every part of the world.
And I know a couple of weeks ago, your office released the State of Climate 2013. And it was a report that you co-edited. With half of 2014 behind us right now, what do you think at this point will be some of the key points of next year's report?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that we can look at is temperatures. And last year, and again, we can look at these big climate patterns that we've been talking about, the El Niño. In 2013, we were in what we refer to as an ENSO neutral state. So that means that we weren't in El Niño or La Niña. So temperatures were close to average in the equatorial Pacific Ocean. So you don't really have much of an influence on temperatures across the rest of the world when you're in this state. Now, in 2014, of course, we're moving into the El Niño phase. So for 2013, when we were in the neutral state, global temperatures for the whole year, for the whole 12 months, depending on which data set you look at, and everybody does a little bit different analysis, but the trends are mostly the same. And we were anywhere from the second to the sixth warmest on record. This year, for the first 6 months of the year, we're already tied for the third warmest. And if El Niño does continue to develop, and I believe right now they're forecasting a weak to moderate El Niño, if it does continue to develop, we could be looking at record warmth for the year 2014.
That was Dr. Jessica Blunden, a climate scientist in the climate monitoring branch at NOAA's National Climatic Data Center in Asheville, North Carolina. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.